here we go.
Okay, we come to likelihood, and
where I'm going to start is with Bayes' formula. So you can say, well, we're doing Bayesian too, but no, actually it's reintroduced a little later. So it's part of our course pattern of talking about things before we talk about them. And what I want to do is show you a odds ratio odds ratio version of Bayes' formula. And it's actually works out quite nicely. And it basically says, suppose you've got some data you've collected, and you know things like its probability under two different hypotheses, the probabilities under two different hypotheses. And we also have prior probabilities of the hypotheses, that's probability that the hypothesis is true, based on whatever, but not yet based on the data. So based on other considerations beforehand. We're going to be getting rid of these priors and posteriors in a moment and then come back to them when we consider Bayes' theorem. But one way of thinking about it is to think of yourself as being a gambler, and you're gambling between two options. And you have a ratio, you have an odds ratio. So you think in advance that there's a 3-to-1 odds in favor of hypothesis 1 over hypothesis 2. And that's this ratio here, it will be 3-to-1, it's the prior odds ratio. And then, you know, you're about to bet on this horse race, and somebody comes and gives you a little hot tip about how well certain horses may be a little injured, and that changes the odds ratio. And what it's going to do is it's going to multiply it by this thing, which is turns out to be the likelihood ratio. It's the probability of that data if hypothesis 1 is true, given hypothesis 1, divided by the probability of the data given hypothesis 2. And what you can show from Bayes' theorem, Bayes' formula, is that this multiplication of ratios holds. The prior odds ratio gets multiplied by this likelihood ratio, and that gives you the posterior odds ratio, which is taking that into account, what should be the odds in favor of horse 1 instead of horse 2. So that's the structure of using prior and posterior information. And the interesting thing is this multiplier, the likelihood ratio. And the interesting thing is what happens to it when you accumulate more and more and more data. So what I'm going to do is just show you that what happens algebraically, and then I'll make it a little more real. If you collect independent items of data, so you have the probability based on rumors you've collected from, about the horse training, then there's a probability based on the weather conditions on the track and so on, then the probability of all that data can be assumed to be a product of independent probabilities of that this data would arise on this on hypothesis I here. Probability that the second kind of data would arise, and so on down to the probability the nth kind of data would arise. And when you do that same computation, basically what happens is each time there's a new item of data, a new independent item of data, there's a new ratio of the probability of that data under hypothesis 1 and under hypothesis 2. And this term here, you keep multiplying by it. And it is a product of those ratios. So the final odds in favor of horse 1 or horse 2 are the original odds times this product of ratios. And I'm going to be arguing that if the amount of data is large, this term here gets to be dominant. And in order to do that, I have to probably show you a simple example. Let's see. I'll be giving you, when we get to Bayes' theorem, I'll give you another reintroduction to this. The example that I want to use here, well, what I'm going to be arguing is that in cases where you've got a lot of data, this term is going to dominate the whole thing. And if this term gets very extreme, then it almost doesn't matter what the prior probabilities are. It will point towards the correct hypothesis. To give you an example, and then what we're going to do in a likelihood-based inference is actually ignore the prior odds and not be able to calculate the posterior odds, but we're going to ask which hypothesis is pointed to most firmly by this term, the likelihood ratios. Which hypothesis has the highest probability of giving rise to the data that you see? So given that data, under what hypothesis does your existing data, is your existing data most probable? And that will be the likelihood. And let me show you a very simple example, the simple example everybody uses for teaching of this. And that is, let's toss an independent coin 11 times, and we get a particular sequence of heads and tails. So HTT, HTH, HTTT. And if we ask ourselves, OK, what's the probability of that data under the assumption that the probability of heads is P? Suppose what we don't know about the coin is whether it's fair or not. We know it has some probability of heads. We're going to assume that the tosses are independent. And under that that probability of heads P, this sequence of tosses will simply be, when you get an H, there's a P, and when you get a T, there's a 1 minus P. So P, P, 1 minus P, 1 minus P, P, 1 minus P, and so on. And then you take those, and you collect all the P's, and you collect all the 1 minus P's, and you see P to the 5th, 1 minus P to the 6th. That's the likelihood. And so what we're going to say is, OK, the likelihood will be maximized where for what value of P? Well, one way you can do it is just take derivatives and say, OK, we'll consider ourselves plotting this against P. Where is the peak? It'll be at the point where the slope is 0. So what you can do is take derivatives of this, and you get this thing. And then you can factor it a bit. You can say, well, everyone has some 1 minus p terms, in fact, 5 of them. And everybody's got some p terms, 4 of them. So it's p to the 4, 1 minus p to the 5th times, 5 times 1 minus p minus 6p. And if you say, OK, where is that equal to 0? Well, these terms cannot be 0 except when p is 0 or 1 minus p is 0. Those are not maxima. They're, in fact, minima. Because there is evidence, very, very concrete evidence, that P is not 0 and P is not 1, which would be required to make those 0. But this term can be 0, and when you solve for it, you get P equals 5 elevenths. In other words, it's simply the empirical fraction of heads. And that's an interesting thing about maximum likelihood estimates is it's... When you make maximum likelihood estimates, you will find out that you've been making them all along. You just didn't know it. That the estimation of the probability of heads by simply counting the fraction of heads is a maximum likelihood estimate. The estimate of the mean of a sample drawn from a normal distribution by simply taking the sample mean is a maximum likelihood estimate. Numerous estimates that you've already know and love are maximum likelihood estimates. Some aren't. But so this is just the empirical fraction of heads. Another way of doing that, okay, here is what the curve of likelihoods looks like for that case. There it is plotted. The peak, yeah, please.
And this is the maximum likelihood. This is the likelihood of getting that original heads-tails sequence?
It's the probability of the data.
Okay.
Given the hypothesis, and here we're not considering it as the probability. I mean, when you do probabilities, normally what you do is you take a given hypothesis and you say, what are all the probabilities of all the different kinds of data that could arise? Mm-hmm. Here you're going the other way. You're saying, given a type of data, let's vary the hypothesis. And the result is that actually feeds right into something you see here. Because you look at this and you'll see, okay, there's the peak. It's the point where the slope is zero. It's a little sort of grid effect up there, so you can't quite exactly see it. But here, 0.5454 is 5/11, which is the peak. And you may look at this and say, ah, yes, a normal distribution. No, it's not actually a normal distribution because for two reasons. Normal distributions have tails that go off to infinity. This one, the tail just goes to zero and goes to one. But the other is that the area under this is not one. In a normal distribution, or any kind of continuous density function, the area under it is one. Because the sum of the probabilities of all outcomes has to be one. But what we have plotted down here are not all outcomes. It's for the one outcome. It's all hypotheses. This curve can be, the area under this can be grossly different from one. It's not, as I recall, we didn't show you the scale over here, that the area under this is a lot less than one in this case. So it's not a density function. It's not the probability of all kinds of data. It's the probability of the particular data, varying the hypothesis that led to it. Now, that's the difference. The word likelihood and the word probability in English are basically the same. But in statistical theory, the sum of all probabilities is one, but the sum of all likelihoods is not, because the likelihood is conditioning going the other way and varying the hypothesis. So what you'd say is, if I toss the coin 11 times and get 5 heads, then 0.454 is the bias. It's the heads probability of the coin that makes that most likely happens to be exactly the empirical fraction of heads. The other way you can maximize the likelihood, by the way, the same curve, is to take logarithms. You remember that the relevant term was that the likelihood was p to the fifth, 1 minus p to the sixth. If you take logarithms through, what you find is the log of the likelihood is the log of p to the fifth, which is 5 times the log of p, plus 6 times the log of 1 minus p. Remember that when you take logs, products become sums, so those are added together. And if you take those and say, okay, let's take the point, find the point, the value of p, excuse me, for which likelihood, at which the log likelihood is maximized. Now, the thing about the log likelihood is that it is the log of something increases if the quantity increases. The log of x goes up as x goes up. So if I can find a point that maximizes log L, a p-value that maximizes log L, it will also maximize L. And so you take this, now that's much simpler. Take the derivative 5 over p, the derivative 6 over 1 minus p, equate that to 0 very simply. You end up with p equals 5/11. Again, we'll do a lot of using of logs of likelihood because the likelihoods with independent data items are going to be products of a lot of terms. If you take a product of a lot of terms, of individual probabilities, if you take a product of a lot of terms, the numbers tend to get very small. You tend to get down, 10 to the minus 110 or something. And those get to be a little difficult sometimes to compute with. If you take their logarithms, everything is much more tractable. The products become sums, the log quantities. You can easily deal, instead of worrying about what p to the 1, what, say, a half to the 110 is, you just worry about 110 times the log of a half, which is not a very exciting or stressful number. Okay. Well, okay, that's the theory. I should add a couple of, let me add just a couple of additional things. One is that the estimates you make from from likelihood are not always unbiased estimates. Now, that often freaks biologists out because they go, oh no, we can't have a biased estimate. A biased estimate is not such a bad thing if, as you get a lot of data, the bias goes away. And that tends to happen with likelihood methods. It's also consistent. You remember I told you about consistency back when we were talking about the sometimes inconsistency of parsimony. Well, this method will be consistent. Most likely properly formulated likelihood methods are consistent. Now, anybody who's taken a math stat course will say, well, wait a second, that's not quite true. There's all sorts of conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Most of the cases we will consider there is no problem with those conditions. So I'm going to make the blanket statement, although I know perfectly well that I can come up with cases where likelihood will not be consistent, but not so much in the phylogeny cases that we're dealing with. So there's some statistical theory. It's also true with a large amount of data, the likelihood curve tends to be the same, roughly the same shape as a normal distribution. And as you accumulate more and more data, the curve gets narrower and narrower, but it also approaches the shape of a normal distribution. That leads to some nice things that we can do, we'll see later on, in making statistical tests involving likelihood. And all of this theory mostly comes with a few minor predecessors from R.A. Fisher, the greatest mathematical statistician of all time, who defined likelihood in a paper when he was still a student in 1912 and had major paper on his statistical properties in 1922. People often, biologists who hear about likelihood, often hear about the phylogeny case. They hear my name and they get my name associated with it. And then they go around, I've heard people say, Felsenstein invented likelihood. And I just think, oh no, I hope there's no statistician in the audience. I want to crawl under a rock and hide because the statistician will be saying, Joe, who? What about R.A. Fisher, 1912? What about R.A. Fisher, 1922? What about, I keep forgetting the guy's name, whether it's Edgeworth or somebody, a year or two before Fisher's first paper had a very difficult and incomprehensible paper that also introduced it. So anyway, what we want to do is take likelihood now and go to the issue of how to do it for phylogenies. And the case I'm going to talk about will be DNA. You can do it for any kind of data. You just have to compute the appropriate probabilities. So what we'll want to do is imagine align sequences, and we're going to make an assumption. We're going to assume that at each site, given the true, unknown true tree, that there is a probability of the data that we see at that site, and that those probabilities are of independent events. So the overall probability of the whole set of aligned sequences is going to be the probability of what you see at site 1 times the probability of what you see at site 2, and so on, until we get all the sequences, all the sites. So here is one site. We have a tree. In this case, it's a rooted tree. As we'll see in a moment, for many purposes, we can use an unrooted tree. I'm just going to say it has branch lengths. I'm calling them T, but they're really branch lengths. They're a rate times time. And those rates might differ in different parts of the tree. So we're going to estimate the branch lengths. And we're going to compute a likelihood for this tree topology. There will be likelihoods for other tree topologies and other sets of branch lengths. But for this topology and this set of branch lengths, what is the probability of ACCCCG? Okay. Well, it depends. If we knew what was at these nodes at this site, is this an A, a C, a G, or a T? Or is that? So those are variables, not continuous numbers, but just a nucleotide, one of four possibilities. If we knew those, if somehow our observations weren't just of the tips, or somehow of the ancestors, then we could say, well, there is a way of computing it. We just have to compute the probability under our model of evolution that this thing starts out at X, which might be a base like C. And then there's the probability that in a branch of length T6, that changes to Y. And the probability that X changes to Z. Now, remember, the sites are independent of each other. We're also going to be assuming that the events in this branch and the events in that branch are independent of each other. They're, after all, occurring in separate species. So, yeah?
And all the rates are equivalent?
All the rates are?
Like a clock?
No. We have not assumed a clock. What we're doing is saying those numbers, even though I use the letter T for them, are really branch lengths. And that means they're a product of rate times time, which allows for the possibility that the rates could be different. But in that case, we're not estimating time, we're just estimating branch length. Yeah. So what I'm going to assume is that there's the probability of this change, the probability of that change. We're also going to be assuming that once you arrive at, let's say this goes from a C to an A, once you arrive in an A here, the probability of further changes to A, or that's no change, or to C, are independent of how you got there. Now that is the essential condition for what's called a Markov process. The Markov process is one that once it gets somewhere, it forgets its history, and its probabilities of further change don't depend on any detail of how you got there. Which, among other things, mean there's no counterpart to momentum there. If I am firing a cannon and there's a cannonball flying through the room and I take a photograph of it, in that photograph, if I have a fast enough shutter, I may see you all sitting here with a cannonball suspended in midair. Well, we all know that in physics, that does not allow you to say where the cannonball goes next, because the cannonball has momentum. It could be flying this way, it could be flying that way, or it could be about to drop. These processes don't have momentum. Once you get to an A, well, it's just further evolutionary processes. And population genetics has this lack of momentum. For most models in population genetics, once you get to a genetic composition of the population, what happens next by genetic drift, by migration, by mutation, by natural selection, depends on that, but doesn't depend on how you got there. Okay. So the events in these different branches are all going to be independent. And we know if we have a model of base change, and we just went over a whole bunch of models, we can compute them. So if we knew the bases at the interior nodes, we could just take a product of the probability of starting here times the probability of this change, this change, this change, this change, this change, this change. So there would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 terms. And we could just multiply them together. And then you'll say, well, wait a second, we don't know the probabilities of the interior nodes. So what do we do? Here is, by the way, the overall likelihood is the probability of all the data given the tree. It's product of terms, one for each site. At each site, there's that term, what we're going to have to do is sum up over all the possibilities at the interior nodes. So it'll be the sum over all the possibilities at X, of Y, of Z, of W, so it's a quadruple sum, of this probability, which is itself a product of terms, one for each branch and one for the starting point. And so it's the probability of getting A, C, 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 G, and X, and Y, and Z, and W, given the tree, with the tree being the topology and the branch nodes. Okay. Now, that looks straightforward, and you could say, well, for a data set this size, there's four possibilities at each of those interior nodes, the four interior nodes. That's 256 possibilities. You can do that in the computer, no problem. But suppose the tree gets bigger. Suppose it gets to be 20 tips, which is not, as you can see from your own data, that's not a very large size. 20 tips means 19 interior nodes. That's 4 to the 19 different possibilities. 4 to the 19 is 2 to the 38. 2 to the 30th is about a billion, so it's about 256 billion possibilities. And you look at that and you sort of say, well, just for 20 tips already to doing one site, I've just asked myself to do 256 billion operations, and I'm going to have to do that for every site, and I'm going to have to do that every time I make a change in the tree, like try different branch lengths. I'm going to have to recompute that. And you look at that and say, now there is no conceptual problem, but there's a very real computational problem. So where we're headed now is the economizing on that problem. So here it is, the product over branches, and the one I just described to you. There is that term for a given set of X, Y, Z, W, and it's the probability of starting at X times the probability change in one branch and another and another and another and so on. There are the probabilities. I've arranged them this way for reasons, because I know what's coming. Yeah?
Oh, so in the previous slide, were those supposed to be then summations or multiplication? I'll just sort of get those.
These here, all of these, oh yeah, I must have skipped over this, didn't I? Wait. This probability is not log. This is not the log, but it is summed. It is summed because these things don't multiply because they're not all happening at the same time. They are the outcome. They're the particular outcome at this site. That's summed up over the different different paths it could have taken to get to the tips. And it gets you just the value for the ith site. Those are multiplied. But this thing is just summed. Okay.
So that's worthy of pointing out. Yeah, this is
just the bigger context of that same thing. It's saying, well, we're summing over all X, Y, Z, and W to get this thing. And here are the products, and I've arranged them here, but these are all multiplied by each other. And then they're all summed over what's going on. Here is the actual, what 4 to the 19 actually is, if there are 20 tips, and it's 274 billion. So
what can we do? Is there a way to economize this and make it practical? Well, you know the answer to that, because you know that I wouldn't have raised the question unless I had some sort of answer.
What you can do is move summations as far to the right as possible. Let me go back for a second. Take the sum over W. It's the sum over W of all of this stuff until you get down into here, and here are the W's in this bottom row. So you can take this term here, everything up here, and pull it in front of the W, because it is all things that don't involve W. So you take this one and pull it in front of W, or another way of putting it is you take the W and you can march it forward until it gets here, then it has all these in front of it. So I can do that for each of those. How about Z? Well, there's none of it in the first row, none of it. You can move it in until it sits in front of this third row. At Y, could be moved in as far as here. X can't be moved. Let's see. Now, if we do that, what we find, the X stays out front, the Y can be moved rightward once, the Z can be moved rightward, the W can be moved rightwards. And the interesting thing is that this term here, let's take that one, is things that have Y's in them. They have X's also, the sum of X's out front, but they have no W's or Z's, so you can actually put a parenthesis around both sides of that, and you haven't lost anything. Similarly, the things that have Z are all in this third and fourth, second and third rows, so you can put a parenthesis around them. And the things that have W are all here. Okay, so we move the summations as far right as we go, and we put some parentheses in to economize things. And then the interesting thing is, when you look at that expression, you say, well, it's the same thing. We're computing the same thing. And if you look at the pattern of parentheses, if I just take all this term with the summation and just put the letter A there, it's parentheses around terms that have A and C, and another parenthesis around everything else. Within that, there's some terms with a C and a parenthesis around C and G. And the pattern of these parentheses parallels the structure of the tree. Take a look at the parentheses, there's A, C, and there's C, G, and then there's a C with that. And if we go back to the tree, there's an A, C, and a C, G, and a C outside that, and this is inside a parenthesis, and that's inside a parenthesis. So there's a direct parallel between where the parentheses are and the structure of the tree. Okay, so that is a hint that there is a quicker method. And this is a version, I should say, of, it's going to be an algorithm that's going to be what's called dynamic programming algorithm. We've seen there are such algorithms for parsimony, where instead of counting all paths through the graph, you store some intermediate stuff and are able then to enormously economize on that. The structure of it is going to be just like the parsimony method. You move down the tree, updating some interior stuff in the tree. But here, the interior stuff are little arrays of probability, not counts of number of steps. And what it's going to do is, let me just check the next slide to see, yes, is that it will have terms that the quantities that we will be updating down the tree. You may remember not to work with I'll just disappear for a while. Not to rely on marker pens. That the tree, which had this structure, it was A, C, 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 G, we're going to update a little array of four numbers, and we're going to do it moving down the tree until we get to the bottom. And what are those numbers? Well, those numbers are going to be a thing that I'm bookkeeping as L sub J super I of S. It's it's an array of four things, a little function of state. So the first thing is going to be, it's for site I. It's specific to site I. So we'll put that up in the parentheses here. And we mostly won't write that because it's we know it's for site I. Where it's in a little array of numbers at a particular point in the tree, and let's make the particular point J. And at that point, there are going to be four numbers, one for each possible value of S. That is one for A, one for C, one for J, one for T. And so there is one of these arrays. But then you have to say to yourself, well, what is its interpretation? What is this? It's the conditional, you can call it a conditional likelihood, at site I, of everything at or above point J in the tree, given that point J is known to have state S. And I may recall in the parsimony in the Sankoff algorithm, for example, it was the number of counts from that point up in the tree, given that you knew that it was an A, a C, a G, or a T there. Given each of the given the knowledge, hypothesized knowledge of that it had each of those four states, here it's the probability of everything that you see from there on up in the tree, given the four possible states. So we're calling this a conditional likelihood. One example is this term. L of W at 0.7 on the tree, and I didn't really show you the numbers of the. If you looked anyway, let me just say that some of those quantities in parentheses in the previous expression are exactly that. They're the probabilities given that you have a particular state, W, of everything you see from that point up on the tree. It's not really important to say this. It is not the probability of having those four states. They don't add up to one. In fact, they're usually way smaller than one. It's the probability of what you see, the one thing you see, given those four states. Okay, so let me just then show what the algorithm is. It's the algorithm that we're going to use. It starts up at the tips. I'll come back to the expression up there in a moment. And at the tip, you have an observation. So let's say that you saw a C. So let's say you're up here. You're going to make one of these arrays up there. You're going to put one at each tip. But what number should you put there? I'm sorry for the people on this side in the back, and you may have a hard time seeing this. Let me move this a little bit forward. Well, let's use the definition. Remember the definition. What is the probability that, given that it's really a C, that you see a C? Well, if your observation is 100% accurate, the probability you see a C is 1. If it's really a C, all the time, that's what you'll see. So there's a 1, if I make the boxes be for A, C, G, T, there's a 1 there. What's the probability in the possibility A? If it's really an A, what's the probability that you see C?
1.
No.
Wait.
Sorry?
Sorry.
I'll give you another chance to redeem yourself. That was A.
Yeah.
Given that it's really a C, what is the probability that you see an A? 0. Okay. So what you're going to do is put zeros and ones here. By the way, if you have error in your observations, for example, sequencing error, then you put different numbers in there. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll go 0, just contrivially write down 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and over here it'll be 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay. So you can fill in the tips trivially. And now you come to the next way one down. So let's take this one here. And you're going to say, what is the probability of that, given that this is an A, that you see A and C up here? And this is the calculation here. It is, if this is really an A, it's the probability that you change to an A, they mainly don't change, and then the probability of what you see from that point on, given an A, which is 1. The probability that, plus the probability that you change to a C, times the probability of what you see once you have the C there, which is 0. So it's a sum, for this box, it's a sum of 4 terms. By the way, in the Sankoff algorithm, it was you were doing minimum number of changes, so it wasn't the sum of the 4, it was the minimum of the 4. And they weren't products of things, they were sums of things. But it has the same structure of it's conditional on the unknown state, and you work out all 4 possibilities. So what you have here is this, you're at a point in the tree, let's draw it, where there's a left immediate descendant and a right immediate descendant, each of whom have these capital L quantities. And there is the place you are in the tree, which we're going to call K. Let me draw it right a little more clearly. K. So you're at point K, and there immediate descendants I will call L and R. We have the arrays of numbers here and here. These are going to be these quantities over here. L's, big L's for the little left node for all 4 possibilities, big L's for the right node, well, they're calling them L and Here they're called L and M, not L and R. Sorry for the inconsistency. So it's going to be the sum over all the X's we might see in the left branch. The probability of, given that you start with an S, that you get to X in a branch of that branch length, times the L that you find when you get there. And summed up over X's. So this whole thing goes on in the left branch. A similar thing goes on in the right branch. And then those two sums get multiplied by each other. And that is then the probability. And if you sit down and sort of think it over carefully, work through, you will find that it does in fact compute the conditional probability for each of the four possibilities here, the four unknown possibilities. You have to do this product, each four, the sum over four things, the sum over four things, and the product for each value of S. So you're going to do it four times. When you're done, you've got the L box here. Now what do? Well, you just go look in the tree for another two that have a box underneath the sum filled in, and you do the same computation over here and get this box. Now you look at this one, hasn't been filled in yet, and you take this and this, the branch lengths, do the computation, get that one. Now you've got these two, you could fill in that one. So you get down to the bottom of the tree. Notice I did not have to do 274 billion computations. Well, before, at each site, there were going to be 274 billion computations. I did an awful lot less than those. I did a sum of two products, a sum over four things, each of which is a product, a sum over four things, and I did that once for each of these. So I did that many times, and that gave me this, and I did similar things here and here and here, much less than 274 billion computations, very, very much less. What this is a version of is a rule called Horner's rule, which is itself also a dynamic programming computation. It goes back officially to 1819. But apparently when they worked through the papers of Isaac Newton, they found out that he knew it too. And Horner's rule is where you have a polynomial a plus bx plus cx squared plus bx cubed plus ex fourth. And somebody noticed a long, long time ago that you could move some parentheses in and really make it simple, because you can take dx plus e and multiply by x and add c and put that in parentheses and multiply by x and add b and put that in parentheses and multiply by x and add a, that this computation here is exactly computes that. And it too has the property, there are nested parentheses, so it sort of has a tree-like structure, of working from the inside outwards, multiplying and adding. So all it does to get all this computation is a multiplication and an addition, a multiplication and an addition, a multiplication, an addition, a multiplication, and an addition. Never had to compute x to the fourth. Horner's rule is a very similar simplification to this one. They're both basically inside out dynamic programming. Okay, now you can compute this thing, but when you get to the bottom, what do you have? Well, you've got four numbers that correspond to the four possible states. And what are they? Remember the definition of this conditional probability. It's the probability of everything you see from there on up. Now, what's everything you see from here on up? It's everything you saw. It's the probability of the data. And so that's what these four quantities are. If your model of DNA evolution is one that goes back and forth among four states in some way, it will have, if you run it long enough, an equilibrium distribution. You'll say, well, if I start a state out and evolve under that model, after a million years, it'll have certain probabilities of being in each of the four states. If you go long enough, those probabilities are these pi of x's that we've been seeing in the DNA models. And the argument is, the sensible thing to do is assume evolution has gone on for a long time before it even got to your tree, to that point in your tree. And so the probability of it starting out in state x is pi x. And you just have to multiply each of these l's for the different x's by the appropriate pi's and add them up. And that is the overall probability. Given a stochastic process started a long time ago, got to the root, and then it's independent in each branch thereafter, and successive branch changes independent, and simultaneous branch changes independent. So it's under this model with the simplifying assumptions. If you have ambiguity, like you mess up the observation, if you happen not to look at a base, you assemble the sequences and suddenly you realize that there was a little breakdown in the sequencing and site 12 in the third sequence never got sequenced. You don't know what it is. It's an unknown nucleotide. What do you put up at the tip? It turns out what you put up is 1, 1, 1, 1. Now you might look at it and say, no, shouldn't it be like a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, so they add up to one. But remember, it's not the probability of different data outcomes. It's the probability of what you saw, one outcome, which happens to be what I saw is, I don't know, given the four possibilities. So if you say, well, what is the probability if it's really a C, given that it's really a C, what is the probability that if you don't look at it, you see nothing? And the answer is 1. Okay, if you don't look at it, it's always 100% probable that you won't see anything. And that's true no matter what the true state of it underlying is. So it is 1, 1, 1, 1. If it's known to be a purine but not known which purine, it's 1, 0, 1, 0. It's not a half zero. I've had to stand my ground. And at one point, a well-known guy who's working in the field, I'll anonymize him, put that in a paper, and he had a half zero, and I said, I was reviewing it, and I said, no, wrong. And there was an argument back and forth, and in the final submitted version of the paper, he thanked me for standing my ground on that one. When the published version of the paper, it wasn't there. Okay, so do not do this. But if you have sequencing error, you can get things like 1 minus epsilon, a third of epsilon, a third of epsilon, a third of epsilon. These are not actually probabilities of different outcomes given the same starting point. They're the probabilities of these different outcomes. You know, given that it's an A, the chance you see an A is 1 minus epsilon. Given that it's a C, the chance you see an A is the error probability, which we're taking simply here as epsilon over 3. So you can actually put a number like for probability of error for simple error schemes into this very easily, trivially, and you can make more complicated error schemes. You might say, well, the error is going to be such we mostly get, if it's a purine, we might more likely get another purine, but if it's a pyrimidine, we're less likely to make an error and call it a purine. So you can put other error structures in. By the way, this has not been done in DNA likelihood programs up until fairly recently when people tumbled to the fact that you could do it. It is trivial because all it does is say what you should put up in the boxes at the top, and then the flow of computation after that under sequencing error is exactly the same. Nothing changes. Okay, so you can handle unknown data and you can handle sequencing error. We're running out of time, and I overshot. Where we will go from this next time is pointing out to you that this whole computation under reversible models of DNA gets you not a rooted tree, but an unrooted tree, because we're going to be able to show that a rooted tree, if you change the rooting of the tree, you can show under a reversible model that doesn't make any difference to the final likelihood. So the maximum likelihood tree is any tree, any unrooted tree that corresponds to that tree, where you can move the root around, doesn't change in a reversible model doesn't change the likelihood. So we'll pick up from there. We are a couple of days behind our course schedule, so later on there'll be some furious, it can be shown that, in rushing past topics, but I think it's important to explain this.